God has been patient with me. He's been kind to me. He's come from my heart. You know, honestly, Morgan, when I look in the mirror today, I like what I see.
Friends, it's Morgan Snyder, and welcome back to another episode of the Become Good Soil podcast. I'm laughing on the inside and the outside because I'm with my good buddy, Greg Lindsay. I can't believe we've been friends this long and we haven't been in the studio yet together.
I know. It's amazing.
This is a moment.
It really is.
Man, we've had some microphones between us, but never in a podcast studio.
That's true.
In various places and offerings. And
yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Martin. It's an honor to be with you, brother.
Man, I'm thinking about Stacy and these girls now becoming women, Sydney, Sloan, Spencer, Stella. I know three are married, and I heard rumor that a fourth is heavily on the way towards marriage.
Yes.
That makes eight kids in the Lindsay home and a mini bus of grandkids on the way. Fill us in. Give me some orientation.
Yeah, well, Stella, I don't know. It's been like three, maybe 6 months ago now. Stella got engaged. So we don't have a wedding date yet. We know it's 2025, which, you know, after having four daughters, paying for another wedding, I'm good with delaying a bit.
That's great.
But we've got grandkids numbers 9 and 10 on the way. So we're going to have our fifth granddaughter in September, and we're going to have our fifth grandson in December.
Man.
So that's so there's going to be 20 of us.
Oh.
When we all get together.
Oh,
now, here's the crazy part, Morgan.
Okay.
We were just together in June, but that was only 18 of us. Well,
yeah.
Well, two were in tow, but not out yet. So not able to create chaos for all of us,
yes.
But for their mothers.
Yes.
So there were 18 of us. But of the eight grandkids now, six of those are three and younger.
Yeah.
So we're going to have eight grandkids, four and younger.
Oh,
eight,
my goodness.
Eight of the 10. So when we're together, it's insane. It's marvelous. It's glorious, and it is sheer chaos. I mean, you just can't. I mean, think about it. There's 10 adults now,
yes.
And we're now. This is the last realm of man-to-man defense.
Even as 10 adults, you're still outnumbered.
We will be.
We will be.
Yeah, we're soon to be the next one that comes, and there's plans for more. And my youngest, Stella, has not even started yet. So when that happens, we're going zone defense.
Oh,
which,
my gosh.
You know, Stacy and I got accustomed to because we had four daughters. And but it's craziness. But man, it is the best thing. And the thing that makes my heart come alive in that the most, Morg, is, you know my story. It's jacked up. I created a lot of hurt and pain for my daughters. You know, and Sid, the oldest, was, this is almost 20 years ago, so 12-ish at the time, and youngest was 2. But to see them want to be a part of big families and to have lots of kids tells me, for all the things that we did wrong, Stacy and I together did wrong, especially me and blowing up, they still receive something really special being a part of a big family.
Yes.
And they want that for themselves, and they want their kids to experience what they experienced when they were growing up. So for me, you know, that feels good. That despite it all, they love family. We have something special, and they want to duplicate that. So for me, it's a big win.
And despite it all, and through it all, you get to be a part of it.
Absolutely.
Right? You're living in the midst of their stories, right? They're not doing that separate from you.
Yes.
But they love rallying the Lindsay tribe.
They love to be together. They do. Now, I have one in Boise, and our third daughter, Spence, and her husband and family, who now live in our basement.
Yes.
So I'm very spoiled because I've got three grandkids in my basement. They're moving to Pennsylvania in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
Where my son-in-law Mike is actually from. So we're going to lose them.
You're actually going to be an empty nester?
No,
okay.
Because Stella's moving back in.
So. Okay, so guys, this is the theme. For years, it's one in, one out,
oh,
one
my
in,
gosh. Good
one
luck.
Out. Oh, my gosh.
But it's glorious. And, you know, having the opportunity to be a part of raising grandsons when God never blessed me with a son has been fabulous. Just a quick note, Atticus is my 3-year-old grandson, and he loves the gladiator tattoo on my arm. And I brought my gladiator helmet home from the office a week or so ago for him to, because I knew he'd want to put it on.
Yeah.
he put it on, and I showed him the scene from Gladiator where Commodus calls out Maximus and says, "Tell me your name."
Mm.
When Maximus turns around and then he takes the helmet off, Atticus turned his back to the screen and took his helmet off. 3 years old. I mean, my heart, it could not have been more full. So I'm just getting, I mean, I'm a blessed man. I mean, this story, most stories like mine don't turn out the way that mine has. And to be able to say that our family, we love each other, we're in it for each other, we go to conflict pretty well now. And we're imperfect. We're a mess like every family, but there's just a deep sense of love there. It's a redemption story. It's a story that there's no explanation for other than God. And so, yeah, man, I'm a blessed dude.
Well, Greg, your story is a beautiful story, actually. And, you know, we've spent a lot of miles together over a lot of years. Yes. And I think what struck me in my desire to host you for a conversation was Jesus says pretty simply, you'll know it by its fruit. Mm. You'll know it by its fruit. And there are few men that I know that have consented to God's initiation of their masculine soul into maturity and wholeheartedness as you have.
Well, thank you, Morgan.
There are few.
That's high praise, brother. Thank you.
And the other thing I was praying about this morning is the number of conversations we've had confidentially in my office where I've walked out, you've walked out, and I'm thinking, he's not going to come back. Too much challenge,
no,
too much risk, too much, man, but you, because of the nature of your willingness to risk it on God and his kingdom, I've taken the risk to invite you into deeper and deeper risk.
Yes,
and
you
you've
have.
Said yes.
Yeah.
And I, Greg, I want to say in this moment, I admire that. And it surprises me because most men, especially in your stage of life, really start settling, right? Brené Brown calls it engineering smallness. We cultivate a container of life with, though invisible, sometimes very specific boundaries where we have the appearance of control.
Yes.
Right? And you're taking risks far beyond your season compared to most men, and frankly, compared to most pastors. And I don't have the privilege of being friends with a lot of pastors. It's very sad because my heart is to invest in the shepherds, right?
And when your book came out, you tried.
I totally tried. And
yes,
that was the hardest audience to reach because—
I was on some of those calls.
Oh my gosh. It was actually shocking to me to see the lack of willingness to be open-hearted. And I observe that with compassion because it's a brutal post.
Yes, it is.
But you've chosen to let your masculine initiation, your life in God, your life with Stacy, with your girls, with your son-in-laws, to be your incubator and out of overflow, shepherd the hearts of God's people in a local context for many years. So it is a beautiful story, and I'm honored to get into it. And can you give us some context? So married to Stacy, how many years? And just give us a bit of a picture. And in this context, it's not chimney sweep because I want them to know some of your vocational story.
Got it.
And I want to give my own introduction of you. But before we do that, can you just give us a context so people can know you?
Sure. So Stace and I have been married for 40 years. Just rolled into 40 years in August. And but we were high school sweethearts. Well, I say that, but that's stretching a little bit. I fell in love with her the first time I saw her in seventh grade. She wouldn't go out with me till almost the end of our junior year.
Oh my gosh.
So I was her bestie and her boyfriend consultant for four and a half years until it finally happened and we went on a date and we got married when we were 20. She was in management at UPS. And I went to law school. I went through officer candidate school in the Marine Corps, and then she got promoted at UPS. So I shifted gears and went to law school. And I practiced law for 10 years before I became a pastor. So I was in the courtroom in Louisville and Southern Indiana, trial attorney for 10 years, 3 years as a prosecutor. and then 7 years in private practice, but all litigation for the most part. And then God got a hold of me. I was actually asked to part of a big church in Louisville, great church. My pastor asked me to start a men's ministry. I had no idea what I was doing. This was before Wild at Heart was written. I mean, there were literally three or four books out there, and they were all, none of them were, with all due respect, they weren't Wild at Heart. Yeah. And so we did the best we could just to try to rally men. There was a heavy theme of accountability, and but, you know, accountability without relationship doesn't work real well. We found that out. And so that's when God started really moving in my heart, and they asked me to take over a singles ministry for about 6 months. I started teaching every week, and it was, my passion was ignited in me. It's like every week was a closing argument, but I believed in my client.
Wow.
Which wasn't always true in the courtroom.
Fascinating.
And it's like, wow, man, I get to bring how God's wired me as an attorney, my skill, into a context where I believe in the case and the client every single week. And that's when God said, I want you to spend the rest of your life doing this. And so it was a 3.5 year transition, basically, to transition out of the practice of law. We moved to North Carolina, planted a new church, went gangbusters. I mean, in the first year, we were averaging 600-700 people. And about a year and a half into that, I had an affair, resigned. I say I resigned. I did resign only because I beat them to the punch. They were going to fire me anyway. And then I spent 3.5 years out of ministry. We were still in North Carolina at the time. And 3 years in hardcore counseling with a guy named Rob who would change my life forever. A friend of mine, Michael, who might be listening to this in North Carolina, who does a ministry, kind of an ally ministry with Wild at Heart, took me back to Wild at Heart. He said, Greg, you and I need to go. We need to take a journey back through Wild at Heart. Now, I had read Wild at Heart when it first came out. Yeah. It's funny. Someone gave me a copy. They wrote a note to me in it and said, when I read this book, I think of you. I read the book. I was like, eh, you know, I'm not you, Morgan. I'm not a big game hunter. And, you know, I love guns. I love the military. I love the Marine Corps. I love Special Forces, all of that. But I've just never been that. I mean, shot a few squirrels and rabbits in Kentucky as a kid growing up. But that's just never been my thing. If I'm going to be in the woods, I want to be looking for that little white ball that I just hit in there, right? And so, you know, I read Wild at Heart, thought, good book for men, put it on the shelf. But when I went back to it in my brokenness, where I was at rock bottom and my marriage looked like it wasn't going to make it, there was, you know, I didn't do this because there was a guarantee that do this, it's going to save your marriage. Everything about our marriage said it was over. And Stacy was actually being counseled by pastors and a lot of Christians that she should call it quits. And it's kind of a miracle story that it survived, but he took me back to Wild at Heart. So my counselor was brilliant, Catholic guy. We didn't talk a lot about God, but he took me back into my story. And so for the first time in my life, I started to understand the significance of story, not just my sin, the things I'd done, but the things that had been done to me, said about me. And wow, I mean, when it was like our third meeting, he said, here's your homework assignment. I want you to between now and the next time we meet next week, I want you to write down, start making a list of every painful moment you can remember in your life, going back as far as you can remember into your childhood, as far as you can go. If it's 3 years old, it's 3 years. And I was so angry with him, Morgan, because I was like, look, dude, I need you to fix my marriage, not my mommy stuff. Like, you help me now. Make sure I don't lose Stacy and my girls for the rest of my life. And then we'll do whatever kind of things you want to do as far as childhood goes. But this is why I'm here. Because any day my wife could say, we're done. I mean, I'm hanging by a thread and I need you to. And he's like, nope, this is what we're going to do. He held to it. And I started to construct this list. I think my first list had like 35 moments on it, going all the way back to as far as I could remember. When I was a kid, you know, I grew up the skinny, scrawny, redheaded kid. Puberty came late for me. I was a freshman, you know, 5'9", 114 pounds. I'd rather be dead than red on the head. I always felt weak. I was humiliated in seventh grade on the pull-up bar by the PE teacher. And I just started looking at these moments. And it was hard for me to actually write them down because I'm like, man, that's nothing compared to the stories of other guys I know. You know, I didn't have an alcoholic dad. My dad was present. He did the best he could with me. His dad died when he was 6, so he was never really fathered. But he did, all things considered, he did a good job with me. So I didn't have the story. You know, start writing this stuff down. You're just like, I'd rather be dead than red on the head. That was nothing. I used to get in fights over that when I was a kid growing up. you know, some things my mom said to me, you know, I've got significant mother wounding in my story, but I started to write this stuff down and I was embarrassed to even take the list back to him.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I'm like that. I don't even want to admit that hurt, but all of that stuff had certainly, and I started to understand why that the affair had nothing to do with sex. And when my buddy Michael took me back through Wild at Heart, John makes a comment in Wild at Heart about most affairs have nothing to do with sex. Mm. I lost it. I mean, I was like, yes, somebody knows that. 'Cause I loved my wife. I was physically attracted to my wife. Now, I don't know as husbands that any of our sex lives are ever what we want them to be, but I didn't really have complaints in that area of my life. And yet here I am over here in left field, blowing up everything in the world and having no clue. My biggest fear and concern when I blew my life up was I did it and I had no idea why I did it until my counselor started walking me back into story. And then in the middle of that, I'm going back through Wild at Heart. And oh my gosh, it lit me up. It put me on fire. I mean, I say to this day, John's work, Wild at Heart, and everything he's written or taught since, you know, saved my life. It literally saved my life because about 2 weeks in, I had a moment where I had my Glock 40 on the desk in front of me. I was the only one at home, and I was thinking my life insurance is worth more to Stacy and my girls than I ever will be again. Now, I never picked it up and put it to my head. In fact, a pastor buddy of me called when I was in the of mine called while I was in the middle of that. But you know, I was in a deep dark place. I had no idea why I'd done what I'd done. But it was this journey back into story, the significance of all that had happened over the course of my life, and light bulbs started to come on. I was like, wow, I'm an absolutely broken mess, and I had a lot of work to do. And it ended up being a 3-year counseling journey with Rob for me.
Let's linger for a moment at that inflection point, right? Because like you said, there's a Glock on the desk. What have I done?
Yeah.
I'm in love with my wife. I'm attracted to my wife. And it sounds a little bit like Paul when he says, what I want to do, I don't do. And what I don't want to do, I find myself doing.
Mm-hmm.
3 years
yes.
in a moment of unpacking story. Greg, as you look back at you then from this perspective, how would you describe to men sort of thematically what was going on inside that would lead to the external choices you made?
I was going through I'm pastoring a church and a successful church. I mean, a church that was starting to be recognized and people were saying, wow, you know, so I'm pastoring a church, and Morgan, I was more committed to checking the daily boxes of quiet time than I'd ever been in my life. Like, I had my checklist. I'm going to read a couple chapters of scripture. I'm going to put a few things in my journal. I'm going to pray. I'm going to make sure I pray for these people. I mean, as far as, you know, doing what I thought I was supposed to do.
Yes.
But there was an absence of God in my life. I had my Jesus experience, but I hadn't really experienced Jesus.
Mm.
So I had my 11 years old moment, tugs at my heart, go forward, accept Jesus, be baptized. But kind of the church that I grew up in until I got to be 16, 17 years old anyway, it was kind of like, Jesus has done what he came to do for you. Now, your job is to believe the right things and behave the right way until he comes back or you die, whichever comes first.
In contrast to experiencing Jesus, what does that actually look like?
Well, you know, it's the middle section of my book. Mm-hmm. It's the middle 4 chapters. And I'll tell you where that really got ignited for me. It was my first boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're February of 08.
Okay.
So I crashed in 05. In February of 08, I come to Colorado. First boot camp. I'm disoriented. Never been in Colorado before. I had shorts on when I got on the plane in North Carolina. I come out here and there's a foot of snow. The road was closed.
Oh my God.
You all told us that the road was closed on the way.
Yeah.
My buddy from Ohio and I are like, oh, there'll be a detour. So we get to the literal road is closed. It's like 12 inches of snow. There's barriers. Like, you're not going. We had to backtrack all the way. And then we called and got a hold of Polly or somebody who said, no, you're going to have to go back and go, you know. So we were late. We were actually walking in as John was starting the first session. So we missed dinner the first night. But I'll never forget, John unpacked Luke 4. He taught at that boot camp. And, of course, every session, Heart of the Man, you know, all the stuff is good. It's funny because, you know, Craig becomes an integral part of my life for 8 years. And Craig was my least favorite speaker at that boot camp. He was the one I connected with the least.
Yes.
And then God says, here's this gift I'm going to give you for 8 years. And he was that. But John taught on Luke 4. And it's the Isaiah 61 moment where, you know, Jesus goes to his hometown church, not a good idea, and stands up and reads Isaiah 61. And before he sits down, everybody's looking at him and says, yeah, this is talking about me. This is what I came to do. Now, in my limited perspective to that point in time, even as a pastor, you know, I came to set prisoners free. I'm like, I'm not a prisoner. Okay, that's great. You got a prison ministry. You know, to restore sight to the blind. Well, I got vision, so that, that, you know, rather than looking at this like, okay, what's holding me captive in my life?
Yes.
Rather than looking at this, what am I not seeing that I should be seeing or I need to be seeing in my life? There's a freedom available to me through this stuff that, you know, so for me, Jesus was all about forgiveness, this idea of freedom. I didn't even have a category for it. Mm. And John taught that and it clicked with me. I was like, that is it. That is what I'm missing in my life. So heal, redeem, restore, all that Jesus came to do for me, I had no category for any of that. But John taught, he taught that passage from Luke 4, and it opened my eyes up to it. I'm like, that is what's missing in my life. That's what I want to spend the rest of my life chasing after. Mm. There's so much more available in life with Jesus that I've just not experienced.
We go back to this inflection point of the affair.
Yeah.
And you have the academic categories, right?
Yes.
Jesus is salvation.
Yes.
But you've never experienced freedom. Mm-hmm. And life in him. What was the disconnect? Help me understand, like, what is it that you were looking for and why did it look like it was there? And contrasted to say, like, now, right?
Right.
Where, and I'm gonna just get super practical. I mean, you're pastoring most Sunday mornings, and a beautiful woman comes up and tells you, you're amazing.
Yes.
Like, what's different now internally? Because I know a lot of men are listening to this going, yeah, man, I know I'm at risk.
Yes.
And I don't know why.
Yes.
Or what to do with it.
Well, I think that, you know, another thing that has come to me is the you know, there's all the ways in scripture that the enemy is characterized or we get images of the enemy. But it's you know, John 10:10, life to the fullest. I love how Jesus connects that with the thief who wants to steal, kill, and destroy. So what does that look like in the daily context of my life? What is the enemy actually trying to steal from me? I am convinced, Morgan, that more than anything else, he wants to steal my ability to look in the mirror and see myself like God sees me. Mm. I didn't have that. I was an invalidated man with something to prove. And when you grow up skinny, scrawny, now I was an athlete. I was a really good basketball player. That was my saving grace. In fact, I've done some good heart work here at the outpost with a tribe of people. Mm-hmm. And we went after that. One of them got a vision. She didn't know my background at all. We never even talked about my life with basketball. Basketball was my proving ground. It's like, okay, you want to look at me and laugh at me because I'm skinny and scrawny and redheaded and freckle-faced and all that was true. Let's go on the basketball court. Let's see who's laughing when we walk off. Mm. So basketball became my proving ground for me. But I was very susceptible because of my story of all of that. And there's so much more. I talk about some of it and some more of it in the book. But my messages that came loud and clear to me from as far back as I can remember, right? You're weak. You'll never be strong. You'll never have what it takes to be a man. And here's the big one. And even though I'm married to a beautiful woman, and you know I am because you've met her.
Oh, yeah.
And you've hung with her.
Uh-huh.
No beautiful woman's ever going to be attracted to you and want to be with you. And as you know, I go back in time. So this happened at about the 20-year mark for us in our marriage. And you know how it is. I don't know how long you and
yeah, we're 25.
And Cher have been married. Okay, you're 25. You know, it can be good, really good, mm-hmm. and still, you know, God has designed beauty in such a way that we see it.
Yep.
And so it's to have someone come up to me and it, I don't, you know, I don't want to blame her. Right. I take total responsibility for what happened in my story. But someone to say, you look really nice today. I mean, Morgan, I can't remember one time in the course of my life to that point I'd ever heard that from Stacy or anyone else. I'm not blaming Stacy.
Yeah.
Then you fast forward a couple weeks later and I'm hearing, you know, I've always been attracted to redheaded men. Mm. And so now all of a sudden this thing that's been my curse, you know, I was like, what? I mean, my head didn't snap like it was on a swivel, but it was like, what'd you just say? I need to hear that again. You know, so the thing that has been my albatross, this thing that I can't overcome, this poor self-image, this I'm weak, I'll never be, is like, no, that's not true. Mm. It's like, tell me, I need to know more about that. So I don't know if I'm answering your question specifically, but, you know, it's all this story stuff that, and I take total responsibility. I wasn't high, I wasn't drunk, I wasn't under a trance. I remember making a decision. The decision broke my heart, and I knew what the right thing to do was in the moment. But, you know, honestly, it came down to this. I need this.
Yes.
More than I need God as I know him right now.
What I hear in just the share and the vulnerability is this core subterranean longing for identity.
Yes.
Right? I mean, this word identity, I remember in your book, it's part of the story is just really powerful. And Stacy had written you a letter.
Yes.
There was a note on the chair. She didn't know what happened. And it was sort of a love note, right? And in it, she wrote, thank you for who you are. And in the book, you shared, and in that moment, I had no idea who I was.
Absolutely.
So the vulnerability of an exterior world that's just booming with success and looks great. And yet inside, I don't know who I am, and I have an ache and a longing and an unmet need that's valid, right?
Yes.
And that's what I hear in it with so much compassion, Greg, is the need is valid. You want to be, you know, as they say, an attachment work of safe, and you want to be secure, and you want to be soothed, right? And seen.
Yes.
And someone comes along and says, I see you.
Yes.
And right, you said the cunningness of evil to take the thing that was always your curse, the thing in the way of you being seen, and she says, I love you for that.
Exactly.
Right? And so in some ways, this has nothing to do with an affair. This has nothing to do with sex.
Right.
This has nothing even to do with a particular woman as it does to do with this masculine heart that has valid needs. They've gone unmet and having not yet at the time become a student of your own story.
Absolutely.
You are sitting duck.
Yes. I've traveled the road I've traveled and I did it. But I was totally unaware. I remember, so the day after, so I resigned on a Friday. On Sunday, they told the church. I obviously wasn't allowed to be there. That was so hard. The next day, one of my buddies in the church, he walked out to the lobby. And what they said to the church, I never got the opportunity to say anything to the church. I wrote a letter and they refused to read it. So there are people now 20 years later who never heard.
Mm.
Where I was in this, which that's still that makes me sad.
Yeah.
But one of my buddies walked out into the lobby on a cell phone, called me, because they had just announced, and all they said was, we've had a moral failure in leadership. Well, I'm the only one that's not there. So he called me, he's like, dude, what's going on? I was like, man, I'm a mess. And we met for coffee the next morning. He said, let's meet. He said, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to do, but I'm your friend. He said, let's meet. We met for 3 hours, I just cried. And we left that meeting. He was just trying to be the best friend he could. He had no idea how to handle what was going on. And he called me on my way home. Stacy hadn't kicked me out yet. And he said, "Hey, Greg," he goes, "my family, we're going to the beach next weekend. And I just talked to Susan, his wife, great couple. And we just called down and reserved a condo for you and your family in the building next door to on the beach where we're staying. And we'd like for you and Stacy and the girls to come and your girls can play with our kids and you all take as much time as you need." I'm telling you, Morgan, that weekend was instrumental in saving our marriage. As you can imagine, Stacy was a mess. The girls had a blast. They played with Todd and Susan's kids and we walked the beach for hours. At night, we'd get the girls all in bed and we'd sit out on the balcony overlooking the ocean and talk all night long. And all I could say to Stacy, I said the same thing I just said to you. "I have no idea why I did this. I don't know why I did this. I'm going to find out. But this is not the man that I want to be." And I told her, I started to talk to her about the man I dreamed of being. And I think that time together over that three-day weekend was instrumental in God holding things together. And then I get with my counselor, Rob, and we start working on stuff. And I mean, I come home and share stuff with her. And I'll never forget, I was sitting on the toilet. And she loves to tell this story too. I'm reading Wild at Heart on the toilet. And Michael's taking me back to Wild at Heart. And she's in the other room. I'm like, Stacy. And she doesn't like, she's kind of got this etiquette where if you're behind a closed door in a bathroom, you don't talk to people.
That's very Southern, I think.
I think it is. She's a Kentucky girl.
I made
girl,
my bathroom so I could
Yeah, so talk this is my
Sharon
private time.
Okay.
Yeah. But for me, it's like, no holds barred. Let's talk, you know? So I'm like, I'm sitting here. I might as well talk. So I'm like, Stacy. She's like, "What?" I was like, "I get it. Oh my gosh, I get it." She's like, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I've been taking my question to you." It was that line in the book that John talks about how we take our questions to our wives and expect them to answer the question. And my wife loved me. She was attracted to me, but in my mind, it wasn't enough. The way the enemy and the warfare and the messages came to me were, yeah, she loves you because you're a provider. She loves you because you get things done. She loves you because you take care of the house and the cars. And she loves you because you're a good dad to the girls. And she loves you because of this. You know, you're safe and you're, but she's not attracted. She's not, she don't really love you. You know, this is what, and so I got this question. I mean, I really believe when I look back at my life and Stacy and I've talked about it a lot since that, and this is not a slam on her because she had no context for story either. And she's got a heck of a story. She had no context for this either. She didn't know she was married to a wounded boy, invalidated man with something to prove, you know. I was desperate for love, unconditional love. And I felt like I've got a beautiful wife, but she's with me because I'm X, Y, and Z. And I provide and I do this and I'm a pretty good leader. And, you know, and but just for who I am, that just sees me for who I am. And I was like, I'm all in on you because of you. I just didn't feel like that was true. The warfare came. But I think that weekend at the beach, my friend gave us a real gift in getting us off the grid so that we could just talk. And it was up and down and lots of tears and, as you can imagine, lots of anger. So and she never, I slept on the couch for a long time, but I never got kicked out of the house. A pastor friend came to our house about 4 or 5 days after it all happened, came into town and counseled her to kick me out. She said to me, she said, "It makes a lot of sense, probably what I should do." But she said, "I'm a broken mess and I need help raising these girls. So, you know, there's no guarantee we're going to take it day to day, but you can sleep on the couch and you can be their dad," which was a real gift to me too. Because Morgan, I'm telling you, one of the most painful parts of there's so much pain in the story. And I don't mean to gloss over it or fast forward, but, you know, the day after it happened, when she thought she was going to kick me out, I was at, that next morning, on Saturday morning, I had Sloan, our second daughter, at softball practice, so I took her. And while I was there, Stacy called me, and she said, "Here's what you're going to do." I was like, "Okay." She said, "You're going to come home, you're going to pack your bag, and you're going to sit down with your two oldest daughters, like 12 and 10 at the time. You're going to tell them exactly what you've done, and then you're leaving." And I started begging her. It's like, please no. And she hung up on me. Mm. And so I endured the rest of softball practice. I drive home thinking that's going to be the game plan. And after, I don't know, God just did a miracle thing there. I don't know if it was how I handled the hearts of my girls, how I communicated to them what I'd done or what she saw in me. But that, after that, I sat down with my two oldest and told them what their dad, they kind of understood, mm-hmm. but they didn't really understand. That's when she pulled me aside and said, okay, you don't have to leave, but you're on the couch and we'll take this one day at a time. And that was a roller coaster ride, man. We'd have good days and terrible days. But that's why I was just giving her everything I was learning in counseling. I'd go to a counseling session with Rob and I come back and I mean, like these moments in my story, it's like, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why it's so significant, but something feels like it is. And you know, when my mom did this or this happened to me, or I got in this fight in a baseball game, or the gym teacher humiliated me, or this girl did that, you know, I just constantly shared. And then I'm learning in Wild at Heart and it's all coming together and I'm just looping her into as much, but it was, I'd say probably 6 months to a year where it was uncertain. I was on a daily question mark of, you know, are we still in the same space mm-hmm. tomorrow? And that's fair. I mean, good grief. I mean, you think about what I've done to her, to our girls.
You know, I'm going to more recent moments because in some ways that story feels as you're sharing it, like that was 6 months ago, right? I mean, it's visceral. It's like, you remember the details. And the beauty of it is we're talking over 15 years ago.
Yeah, almost right? 20. I can't wait till it's 20.
I mean, almost 20.
Over 19.
And I mean, you're going to cross the mark where more of your marriage is on this side
yes.
of it.
Yes.
And today, I have the privilege of walking with you and watching you minister out of overflow.
Yeah.
Your girls love you.
Oh, gosh.
Your son-in-laws want life with
yes.
you. You and Stacy have a united
yes,
front.
Yes.
And so what I'm curious about, Greg, is that was actually the beginning
right.
of a story of a true restorative process
yes.
of a life in God.
Yes.
And so you're saying a year and a half was rocky, but now looking back over almost 20 years,
yes.
what was it that God did and is doing to restore that deep-seated need for identity where you can say, I don't want that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Morgan, because the affair and the events that followed for the next 3 years, and so if you fast forward 3.5 years later, this little tiny church called Discovery Church in Colorado Springs wants me to come out and be their pastor. One of the very things that led me down the path, this something to prove thing. And I'm really trying to prove it to myself that I'm worthy,
yes.
that I'm worthy of love, that I do have what it takes to be a man, that I'm not weak, I'm actually strong, that I'm a decent looking guy, you know, all this stuff,
yes.
you know, I got to prove it. It's funny because if you think about it, God brings me to Colorado Springs, drops me into a very, very hard church plant, failing church plant situation. And man, there are naysayers everywhere. Like my first experience with pastors in Colorado Springs, we've talked about it, did not go well. And I did not feel welcome in this city because I told them my story. Because another pastor had suggested that I tell this group of pastors my story. And about 20 seconds in, I knew it was a big mistake. I felt the room freeze over. Now, because I had so much pastor hurt in the last 3.5 years, I wasn't healed enough to do that.
Yes.
So I later owned it 5 years later with these guys and said, look, guys, a lot of that's on me. A lot of it was your response. More of that was on me because I wasn't healed enough. Too many pastors had hurt me. But if you think about it now, I walked away from that and I didn't literally do it. But in my mind, I flipped them all off. I said, screw all you guys. I don't need you. I'm just going to do what God's brought me to Colorado Springs to do. Now, what happened in that 3.5 years was God said, Greg, you are going to be back in ministry. About a year and a half in, I really started feeling that because everybody's telling me it's over. Like, go find another profession, take the North Carolina bar exam, you know, get back to this part of your life is over, which broke my heart because I felt like it was the call of God on my life. But I get to Colorado and I got all these naysayers and now it reignites the something to prove in me. I flipped them all off. I said, I'm just going to do what God's, but what God told me when he brought me, he said, we're going to go somewhere else and we're going to do this differently. And it's going to be all about rescue. It's going to be all about, I had no clue. How do you do, Wild at Heart and Ransomed Heart in a church context, but God said that's what we're going to do. We're going to go, we're going to rescue hearts. Everybody's going to start to experience healing and redemption and restoration. And then I get connected with McConnell in my first couple months here, and McConnell never answered the question in 8 years, how do you do this in church? I think he was hoping I would figure it out and tell him.
That's great.
In typical McConnell fashion, that's, you know? Great. But it's interesting that it had to get harder before it got easier. Because of me being rejected by, and people would hear my story, people would leave the church. In fact, they moved us out here in August of 08 to take over the church. And I preached my first sermon on August 10, 2008. So I just celebrated 16 years not too long ago. On Tuesday, the following Tuesday, the search committee chairperson that hired me came into my office and said, we need to talk. And we talked. And he was him hauling around. I was like, what's going on? He's like, well, we haven't exactly told the church your story.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, wait, what does exactly mean? Well, we haven't told him. We thought you should tell him. So Morgan, in my fifth week in Colorado Springs as the new pastor of this church, I preached John 21, Peter's restoration, and I told my story, and half the church left in the next 3 months.
Wow.
People left the church that day. So you talk about rejection. I had it from Christians who weren't comfortable. I'm not comfortable with a pastor who's done that. I get it. And from other pastors in town who made me feel unwelcome. Mm. And so now this something to prove is reignited in me.
And that identity is being really challenged.
It's really challenged. So God led me into even more of a fire to work through the very things that we're talking about. And so, you know, I, and you know, because we've walked a lot of it together. Because I met McConnell, I met you shortly after that. I've been to 5 boot camps, advanced camps, taken a bunch of guys there, been to Become Good Soil and facilitated there with you and you know, done Ionis here at the Outpost, just been a part of the tribe here. But it's been a long, hard journey. The last 16 years of leading this church has been by far the hardest thing that I've ever done. And that has constantly been challenged. Mm. The other piece of that is, you know, I still hadn't outgrown wanting to be a big deal.
Mm.
I felt like I was on the road to being a big deal as a pastor in North Carolina because our success was so quick and just like people were looking. They're like, oh my gosh, you know, next North Point, da 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 da. And, you know, God has been patient with me. He's been kind to me. He's come from my heart. You know, honestly, Morgan, when I look in the mirror today, I like what I see.
Mm.
And I don't care. I don't care, woman, man, whatever. I still see beauty around me. I'm 60 years old now. But guys, if you're out there listening, you don't outgrow it. You still recognize beauty. And you know, God did that for us. It's a gift, right? But I walk in different space, man. I'm tired of trying to be a big deal. I honestly, I'm not trying to be self-righteous, but I want everybody to experience what I've experienced and what life with Jesus can really be, the healing, the redemption, the restoration. To have a wife that now we've journeyed for 40 years in marriage together, and we dated for 3 years before that. So we've been together, you know, 3/4 of our life, who loves me like she does, and I am her hero. And, you know, she writes 3 or 4 pages at the end of the book.
Beautiful.
Just giving her perspective on this journey over the last 19 years. But to see our relationship and my girls, I am a hero. I am a hero to my 4 daughters. They love me. They adore me. I don't deserve that. But the work that we've done, I think that, you know, God helping me be aware of my own story has certainly opened my eyes to the role I've played in theirs and the role the affair played. Now, the 2 youngest, they don't really have much memory of it. Mm-hmm. They were young. But it's been very public since I told my story in 2008.
Yes.
And they've said in church, it's not talked about every week. In fact, one of the biggest gifts you ever gave me was when you challenged me to take a year without even mentioning it.
I did.
And I did it.
And I was so proud of you.
And it was life-giving for me to do that, right? Because you keep telling it, the enemy wants to convince you that's who you are.
Yeah.
It's not what you did, it's who you are. Mm-hmm. And so that was good for my healing journey to just like, no, let that go. You know, and so they've heard it several times. It's in the book. They know the book that's dedicated to them. But it's brought up some interesting things with my girls. You know, you mentioned 3 of my girls are married. I've had the privilege of doing all 3 of their weddings, and I'm going to do the 4th one. And it's really cool because I get to walk them down the aisle, have someone else say the welcome and then hand off to me. After I say her mother and I just shift places and take the place and do the wedding. It's been cool because I've had the opportunity to get to speak some real good truth into my sons-in-law on their wedding day during the ceremony. But heading into that, I've sat down with all three of them and I said, look, here's the deal. You're going to have to be careful not to project what your dad has done onto him. There's going to be a piece of you that's going to have a tendency to, can I really trust him? And because my dad did this thing that I never would have thought my dad would do. That's not who he is. And so you're going to have to watch yourself not to project dad onto your husband and have a lack of trust for him because of something dad did, not something he's done or is doing. So it's been, those aren't fun conversations to have because it just kind of pulls the scab off a little bit. Again, but I feel like they're necessary. You know, just understand this is a part of your story. But we've just been able to, it's just a miracle, Morgan. There's no explanation for any of it except for God.
I'm thinking about these precious daughters and these young men.
Yes.
That they're marrying that are just like us.
Yes.
Right? And yes. That idea of masculine initiation is unique and it's universal. And
yes.
You know, every man is at risk.
Yes.
To the proportion in which we are unaware of our story, of our identity. And so, Greg, when you think about loving them, and frankly, other men leading in your church and men in your community, how has your path formed you in how you counsel them, what you offer them, how you help them see clearly so that your pain isn't wasted?
Well, I walk into story with my with my sons-in-law. And
meaning what?
Like you and me, they have their stories too. I mean, I ask them what life's like growing up. I ask them about relationships with their parents. I don't even have to ask them because of the nature of how we roll as a family. They tell me. And, you know, there's a lot of, as you know, because you've devoted your life to it, there's a lot of father and mother wounding out there. And to be able to say, I see it, I get it, me too. And to get ahead of it and to just have conversations that create an awareness in them.
Yes.
You know, so what does that do to your heart? And conversations that I was not equipped, I had no context for and wasn't equipped for 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But we just go there. I mean, that's one thing I say about our family, and we talked about it when we started. It's chaos, but it's messy, but we walk into the mess. Mm. You know, we don't sweep things under the rug. Stacy, my wife's family, grew up doing that. It's just like, you just act like it doesn't happen, it'll go away. We don't do that. We just get after stuff. We have real conversations. It's been really cool. Two of them in particular that have had significant challenges in their stories, you know, have referred to me either in a note or in person the role of, and I'm not trying to replace their fathers, and I could never, would never, but just getting to be a bonus dad in their lives and how they truly, you know, I'm able to father them. I always wondered and really actually was pretty pissed about it that God never gave me a son. Because, you know, I get to see what you get and other men around me. But I realized that God was preparing me to be a better father for many sons, many more than I biologically could have ever had, and ones that I love dearly, and ones that I've entrusted the hearts of my daughters to, which is, I mean, that's a whole nother level. Of which it'll come for you,
not brother. There yet, thank God. One step coming. At a time.
It's coming, bro. Brace yourself. But it's been, yeah, I mean, and my story's public, and I'm open with them about the challenges and so forth, just trying to help them navigate. But I think they have an awareness that I didn't even have a category for when I was in my 20s.
I hear the awareness.
Yes.
But Greg, I also see modeled relationship. They have places to go.
Oh, they do.
You know, one of my mentors, I haven't recalled the story for decades, but I was, I think, 21 years old. And looking to older men, and he had kids and sons. And I thought, and I asked him, like, what's your advice in parenting? And he said, when my son in high school gets a girl pregnant, I want to be the first one he comes to.
Yes.
And I just, like, I didn't have any category for any of that, but it stuck with me for 3 decades.
And you've done that well,
the
brother.
The quality of the relationship, the yes. safety, the grace, culture, the benefit of the doubt. I see it now so much more clearly,
yeah.
But you've offered relationship.
Well, they know, they all know that there's nothing they could ever do that is going to make me an unsafe place for them or cause me to stop loving them.
Greg, there are 2 quotes
yep.
in the book that you chose that really I find myself pausing. And when I think about my own story and I think about masculine initiation, and I'd love to share them back to you and just invite you to comment on why that quote
yep.
and why does it matter?
Yes.
And the first one is from Henry David Thoreau that says, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. And John, in his translation for years, as we know, has translated this for men in church, the mass of men lead lives of sanctified resignation.
Yeah, absolutely.
What? Why that quote?
I think it's, well, you know, when I first heard John say it, and I don't know if I read it first or it was at my first boot camp years ago, it just resonated with me. I mean, I think it accurately nails and describes where I sat when I blew my life up.
Mm.
That on the surface, everybody's like, how and why could this happen? Man, you're killing it.
A picture of success.
You're killing it.
Externally.
Four beautiful girls, beautiful wife, you know, got it going on. Church is growing. Financially, things are good. You know, da-da-da-da-da. Moving and going, making a name for yourself, blah, 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 blah. And beneath it all, I couldn't, if you'd asked me before I crashed about it, I couldn't have put words to it. But I just, when I first heard John said that, or I first read that he quoted it, it just nailed me. It was like, that's exactly where I was sitting. And in my book, the first chapter is, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And the great U2 song. And that was me, that I had all these things that you think would bring happiness, peace, fulfillment, contentment, all this stuff, except for the thing that was missing was a real deep life with God.
Mm.
And so sanctified resignation, that's me as a pastor leading a church. And here's the thing, Morgan, I wasn't a fraud. I was passionate about people coming to know Jesus.
Yes.
But I could only offer them what I myself knew of him.
That's such an important distinction. There is something genuine. It's just insufficient
yes.
for a wholehearted man.
Yes. Yes. And so I was ill-equipped to offer them. When Jesus says life to the fullest, I had no idea what that meant.
Mm.
And honestly, a part of me was like, if this is it, I kind of disagree that that's what you should call it. Because I got my ticket to heaven someday, and I'm trying to believe myself and behave myself to the life I want, but it's not working.
One more quote,
yep.
John Wooden. I wasn't surprised that you picked a Wooden quote. But this one, there's so much in this. And your thoughts. Success is never final, and failure is never fatal.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
I'll never forget, because it was in that season between blowing up and actually getting restored back into ministry, it was in that 3.5 year window that my daughter Sloan returned home during the summer from basketball camp at UNC Wilmington. And the camp shirt had that quote on the back.
Wow.
She came home, she walked into the kitchen. I read that, I started crying.
Come on.
Because I thought my failure was fatal. I thought it was over. Still, it seemed like by that point in time, if I remember the timing correctly, that it looked like more likely than not, Stacy and I were going to make it, but ministry was done.
Mm.
I mean, for the first 2 years, it was crickets when it came to ministry. I mean, I had started working in the mortgage business just to try to pay the bills. That's when the mortgage industry crashed. Jeez. We had just bought this little mortgage company, me and two buddies of mine, so I lost all this money. I mean, it was a train wreck, but that quote is in there because of how it just gave me a glimmer of hope. Mm. I'm learning to experience Jesus. I'm starting to receive some healing and stuff, but man, I needed to see that on the back of a t-shirt. Guy put that in front of me just at the right time.
Greg, your story, it's given me so much hope because you have risked authentically letting your story be known.
Yes.
And inviting God into every part of it.
Yes.
And it's just interesting how I look at you being at the helm of a local church with every flavor, every personality, every story, and how you talk a lot at DCC of your story is safe here.
Yep.
And it takes one to know one.
Yes.
And I just, I see how you have stewarded the story that you found yourself in with courage and with confession and with love and not as a victim.
Mm.
I feel like a way to honor your story and its work in the world and the other lives as we come near a close for this episode is I want to share with our friends listening some of the foreword.
Yeah.
From your book,
yes.
The rest of your story. And I would just love for you to get to receive it in the moment.
That's awesome.
Look, I know we've all had so many helpings of your life can be great. Sermons, podcasts, way too many slices of let's get real authenticity. It makes us nauseous. Some of us have tried hard to combine the two because we were told it would change our lives. But nothing really happened. And nothing really seemed to happen in the lives and characters of folks selling us the programs. No wonder so many people are giving up on God and the Christian faith. It just looks like a lap after lap around the carousel. So here comes along yet another book offering hope and change and by a pastor to make things worse. I feel jaded myself. But I've put my name on the cover, and this is John Eldridge
yes.
writing the foreword. So allow me to explain why. The authenticity movement in the church failed because people didn't have anything to be authentic about beyond their mess. To be real, quote unquote, was synonymous with being broken, only broken. No one was in front of us living out a way through our pain to something genuinely wonderful. Honestly. Far more people have found help in therapist's office than they ever have in a church. Authenticity stuck in brokenness isn't helpful. It's depressing. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, your life can be great. Buffet of Christian promises grew rank because while leaders talked a lot about God and about his promises over time, it didn't seem like they actually knew God, experienced his promises. Loads and loads of shiny content with very little actual transformation, right? Mm-hmm. There are good leaders who actually know and experience God. They have some authority to talk about transformation because they first chose to live it out themselves before they preached it. Greg Lindsay is one of those leaders. Mm-hmm. What's it like to pause, Greg, and sit here in this moment in your life, in your skin, in your family, and receive those words afresh?
Hmm. Morgan, they hit me just as fresh and just as well as they did the first time when John wrote them and sent it to me. I couldn't believe what I was reading. It's overwhelming in a good way.
Mm.
It is affirmation. I think about all the tears, and I think about all the hurt and all the pain. And I'm not just talking about in the weeks and months following, you know, my affair and blowing up. I'm talking about in the last 19 years. In some ways, it's been a really hard journey, and there's been a lot of hard nights and lots of tears and all that. But when I read or hear what John says there, it was all worth it.
Mm.
I hope I just want people to find hope, man. I just want them to find the hope that I don't deserve the life that God's given me. But man, I want people to experience the rescue of Jesus that I've experienced in my life.
Hey, Greg, it's a privilege to be able to share these miles with you and to host a space to bring your story to a global community. Friends, if you're ever in Colorado Springs or you're located here, Greg pastors at Discovery Church, and we're featuring stories from his book, The Rest of Your Story, The Path to the Christian Life You Want. Greg, I'm picturing the men listening, and I'm thinking you mentioning tears, hurt, pain, you know, the banner over DCC, the banner over your work in the world, as you know so well and have shared, embodied, and become, is discover your story, experience Jesus, and live to rescue. And that's who you are. That's who you've become.
Thanks, bro.
And, you know, every Become Good Soil podcast, we like to close with 90 seconds of pause, of lingering, yes, to just notice what God's bringing up. Mm-hmm. And so it feels fitting, as you've pastored me, to invite you to pray and invite listeners into that 90 seconds. And I'm picturing maybe it's the pastor that's at the end of his rope. Maybe it's that guy in the front row that has all the information and still has not experienced Jesus. Maybe it's the guy in the back row that's really tentative but hasn't given up. Maybe it's the guy that won't go in the church.
Yeah.
Maybe all of those different character types are inside each of us. Mm-hmm. But as a pastor going after the hearts of men and women, would just welcome your prayers. Mm-hmm. That would you lead us into, sure, a time to be with God?
Jesus, we just, we come to you. We don't have to pretend. We don't have to dress it up. We just come to you, and we just say thank you for telling us that in this world we're going to have trouble, that the life that you're inviting us into is seldom easier, but it's always better. And I just pray over every heart that's hearing this right now, is they'll truly be able to receive that. But there's a thief in our story who wants to steal from us and kill us and destroy us, but you offer life, and not just life someday, Jesus, not just eternal life. Yes, someday it's going to be great to be with you. We got a lot of gratitude for that. But just, Jesus, you see us now, and you say to us that you're not going to leave us or forsake us today, that despite what we've done, what we're doing, how many times we've done it, who we've done it with, you're never going to let go, that you're never going to stop pursuing us. You're never going to be done with us. And so I ask you to come. For the heart of every person that's listening to this right now, in the hopelessness, who's hanging on by a thread like I was in my life 20 years ago, that you'll come for their hearts in a way that only you can. We pray Isaiah 61, Jesus, the very thing that you stood up and said, this is me and this is who I came to do. That you didn't just come for lost people, that you came, Jesus, for everything that's been lost in our lives and stories, including our identity, including our ability to look into the mirror and see ourselves as you see us. So Jesus, would you come? Would you bring healing? Would you bring restoration? Would you bring redemption? Would you bring rescue, Jesus, to each of our lives and each of our stories today? And Jesus, we thank you that there's always more to experience with you. There's always more to experience to you. So Jesus, would you come? Would you come? You know what each of our hearts need today. You know what we're sitting in this very moment. Would you come and rescue us?
It feels fitting to close this time with Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20 and 21, as you so beautifully used to close in your book. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Jesus Christ throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Friends, it's an honor and a privilege to walk these sacred miles with you. We look forward to being back together for another episode of the Become Good Soil podcast.